KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It is my honor to have sitting across from me the actor Sam Elliott, who's having a terrific year this year with his collaboration with Paul White's grandma, of course his terrific role on Justified, and his work with Bly Danner this year. In fact, it's been the year of Sam Elliott, so it's a pleasure to get him in here. Sam, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Elvis. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure to have you here. We're talking a little bit about comedy, and I guess, obviously, comedy, because God, the first time I really saw you in something would have been like one of those NBC miniseries in the late 70s. Bestsellers,
yeah,
as they call those. They, yeah. All those adaptations, yeah, of novels.
Yeah. It was either Aspen or Once an Eagle.
Once an Eagle.
Yeah.
And
novel by Anton Meyer.
Yes, that's right. And that would have been just about the time of Lifeguard, too, would it not?
Yeah, that was in 74 when we did it. So it came out right about that same time while Once an Eagle was on.
Because you were saying something about, I mean, one of the things I've liked about you being used in this way in the past almost 20 years now, going back to Big Lebowski, is I've always thought there was kind of this, a bit of wit in your delivery, kind of a dry wit, and the Coen seized
very
on that.
Dry.
Dry is good, except in California this time of year, but
yeah.
Generally dry is good in wit, and the Coens kind of seized on that for Big Lebowski.
It did. It was a great opportunity to, you know, I'd been doing this Western thing forever. I'd reached a point in my life and in my career where I started to kind of second guess what I was doing in this box that I'd immersed myself in and the way that I was perceived by people in the business. And then this Coen Brothers thing came along, and I remember I was down in New Mexico with John Milius working on a film called The Rough Riders. He had another Western character. And this Coen Brothers script came to me, and I was so excited when I took it back to the room to read it and thinking, well, I'm going to play one of these wacky Coen Brothers characters. And I open it up, and here's this cowboy character again. You know? I mean, it's... After that experience, I actually embraced the fact that I'd been in this Western box for so long, because it, you know, it's, I think it's really responsible in some way for leading either directly or indirectly to my favorite roles since I've been in the game.
Yeah, because I would have to think that The Contender grew out of that, because that's basically...
It did, indeed.
You're sort of comic relief in that, too. And that idea of the kind of comedy you play where you're not giving anything away, but it's all about timing.
Yeah.
Even playing a cow.
Yeah. Oh, God.
But that, just that pace, that kind of delivery, that a whole new generation of filmmakers saw you as... being a pretty able comedian.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm not sure, but, you know, it actually started, I think, on some level with the funny was, it was after the Coen Brothers. They were really the first to give me an opportunity to do it. But a couple of years ago, I did this thing called Robot Chicken. Which,
yes,
was on,
oh,
the Adult,
yes,
Swim. And
yes,
that was,
yes,
really kind of the beginning of some really nice opportunities that led to Parks and Rec, which I did 3 episodes on. And it was actually Robot Chicken. I was nominated for the voiceover I did there, and it was for an Emmy Award, and Lily Tomlin was nominated at the same time. And that was the night that I had one encounter with Lily before, you know, we'd never met before Grandma.
Really?
And Lily won the award for this African elephant show that she narrated, and, you know, I congratulated her and said hi, and, you know, I'd certainly admired her from afar and been in love with her, like a lot of people from afar, for a long, long time, but we'd never met. And, it, you know, I think it, I'm not sure that it led to this, or to grandma, I mean, but it was serendipitous on some level.
It's interesting because it's so much about, for you, it seems like you having to prove yourself in all these roles. And these filmmakers believe in you, but you have to prove yourself to yourself in some way, don't you?
Yeah, I think I do, you know. I wanted to do this since I was a 9-year-old kid in Sacramento, California, where I went to a Saturday matinee every week. And I knew early on that I wanted to be a film actor by having that experience, going in that dark theater and seeing that light shine through celluloid and see those images on the screen. And it really wasn't about being a movie star. It wasn't about making money. It was about doing what I saw Gary Cooper and those guys doing, those guys that really spoke to me, and also the Flash Gordon stuff, you know. I mean, that was a time of all that stuff, you know.
So you wanted to be,
I think I got into the game, and, you know, I worked with some really incredible people when I initially got started in the business, you know. And
who were those people?
Jimmy Stewart and William Holden, and, you know, I mean, it's a pretty solid list of proven actors, people that I looked up to as a young kid, and people that I had an opportunity to work with in the end of their careers. And I also think I came into it not knowing a lot.
How do you mean?
I wasn't a studied actor. I didn't go to school.
Did you not want to? Did it just not occur to you?
Well, I somehow thought because it was film that I didn't really need to go to school. I thought it was best to learn on the job. You know, I always thought that those schools were for people that were going to do legitimate work on stage.
Really?
Yeah. You know, and which you know, roundabout way of answering your question, why I'm still trying to prove it to myself that I have any capabilities as an actor, maybe.
But it's so funny because a lot of these people you're talking about, like Cooper and Jimmy Stewart, they didn't train as actors. I mean, Gary Cooper was going to be an engineer,
but he was good at being himself.
Yeah.
You know, as Stewart was, you know. It was all about the lines. It was all about the words, I think, and doing justice to what the writer put on the page.
When was the first time you felt like you got it, when you were doing justice to what the writer put on the page? Do you remember when you felt like it, that you really hit it? Because me,
I don't think it was till later on, you know. I mean, I'd like to think that I did some earlier on in the 70s when I first got started.
So you don't think it was Lifeguard at all then?
It could have been. Ron Coslow wrote a script that spoke to me. It was certainly, timing-wise, right up my alley. You know, I lived on the beach. I'd been a lifeguard. I was in peak condition. Both my folks were lifeguards. And, you know, it's something that spoke to me. And having the opportunity to work with Dan Petrie, who was one of my favorite directors in my career and somebody that really I got very close to on a number of levels. You know, I like to think that something right was there, but that whole experience with Lifeguard and the aftermath and the press and me being a glib kind of, I think, honest, opinionated, but at the same time not very smart, you know, in my dealing with the press and maybe people in general. I think a lot of people thought I was kind of a smart ass, and I think I know for a fact that I paid the price at Paramount. I never did work again at Paramount.
Really? Is that cost
and,
you?
And that holds true to today, you know.
Well,
they released a film that I did called We Were Soldiers one time, but, you know, it wasn't anything that...
Well, when you played the cow, that was a Paramount film. My guess who...
That's
still doesn't take him so seriously is Sam Elliott, who's having quite a spectacular year this year, but he's here... I mean, talking about so much stuff. I mean, certainly grandma, but also in Justified, you're talking about doing service to the material. And that was really a case where you did in Justified.
Thank you.
I mean, it really was. This was a guy who basically was very specific about what he said all the time.
Yes.
And there was even that kind of specificity even made, again, kind of comic, you know, funny.
He did. It would tickle you watching this character, I think, a little bit. But, you know, it all goes back to the work, to the material. I mean, you know, and those writers on that show, Graham and his band of merry writers, band of brothers, maybe, you know, since that was something that he did one time. I mean, it's just the stuff they delivered on the page was just brilliant stuff and so much fun to deal with.
But when you get these cases, and there have been so many of these cases, I think about the great Louis L'Amour thing you did, Conagher, where you basically, where the lines tell you exactly who the person is, which seems to be really when you shine as an actor. So this idea of you being unsure is so funny to me, because these are people, some of these characters you've played, I think, are being very definite people.
They were. Conagher was definitely that's the one thing I loved about those older westerns, or the western genre in general, was that they were black and white. There wasn't a lot of gray matter in there between them, and you knew where you stood with most characters. And that was a particularly special thing because my wife and I both developed a screenplay with a gentleman named Jeffrey Meyer. We did the adaptation, and I produced, and Catherine and I both starred in it. That was a great piece. And at the time, I think the highest rated thing that TNT produced. So that was a lot of fun. I hope someday to go back and do another great Western, but I'm not sure that another great Western is going to ever get made in this town, you know.
But I think it becomes a sort of thing where if you take the Western, sort of the ethos of the Western, and move it to another setting, to the small mining town in the Midwest for Justified, for example.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, you could almost say this road picture of Grandma sort of has this sort of thing where you know where everybody is when you meet them, which is something I think about as being a part of Westerns, too.
Right.
We know who your character is when we meet him, don't we?
Absolutely. You know, Carl is a troubled man, and back to that guy again, you know. I don't know. Paul White's writer-director of Grandma. What a brilliant piece of material. And what a grand opportunity. And that, too, you know, this. I think the fact that I'm sitting with you here talking about Grandma today also leads indirectly back to another Western that I did.
Which one?
Or a Western character that I did, and it was with Paul's brother.
Oh, my gosh. In a
show called The Golden Compass.
You really were a Western character in that one.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I remember Chris saying to me, I want you to do this. You're the iconic Western guy. And I was thinking, wow, God. Again, but now I'm iconic, so iconic was great. But I'm sure that led to my stint in Grandma with Lily, you know.
I don't know, because what you're doing here is very different. There's a raw nerve sense to this guy.
No, it's a different animal for sure. I mean, I just meant because of my connection with Chris that Paul tapped me to.
I think it's, well, knowing both those guys, I think there's something a little bit more to it than that, Sam. And I think part of this, too, is that this is something. Unlike some of you played before,
yeah.
and I could see your joy in having a chance to do it. And part of the fun in watching the character comes from watching your joy in playing him.
Thank you.
I mean, well, you must have felt that, though.
I felt it. It was, you know, it was just 11 pages, this piece. But I knew when I initially read it, when it came to me, that this was just something I had to do. And, you know, not only the opportunity to work with Paul, but an opportunity to work with Lily. And as we got on the set, we shot it in 2 days. We shot the interiors in one day, shot the stuff on the porch the next day. You know, it was just kind of an evolution of just one of the greatest times I've ever had, you know, and this character just kept, he spoke to me, this guy spoke to me. It touched me on the page, and, you know, in many ways, you know. Although he was, I think, a lot more complicated than I am on some level, maybe not so, but he'd made decisions in his life that, you know, being married 4 times and having umpteen grandchildren and children, you know, the guy obviously had a few issues somewhere along the way, you know. Maybe he would have been better off had he believed in abortion. I think the truth of it was that he was, you know, Lily left him for another woman, right, at some point, or when they were living on a boat, when they were both in their 20s, and I don't think he ever got over it. I just think he was in love with her still. And when she came to him for money, he was absolutely going to help her out down until the bottom of the scene where he found out what the money was for. And then he still carried that pain from, you know, feeling that she'd done him wrong, you know, when she went off and dealt with an abortion of her own without telling him. You know, he felt he should have been privy to that.
It's interesting, too, because what you're talking about in that scene, when that anger comes out, it's almost like he's a 20-year-old guy again. And your posture changes. You're like looking at her like he's normally kind of, or at least when you see him, he's kind of a laid back guy who waits for things to come to him.
Yeah.
And he completely changes in that moment.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that was one of the things you saw in the material you thought, I know how to play this.
I felt like I knew how to play it when I went in there, but I didn't have any idea where it was going to go, Elvis. I didn't know where it was going to go. You know, I've always thought my job as an actor was to show up on set, know my dialogue, and be ready to do it. You know, and I think actors, I think our job is to interpret the writer's words. And in this case, when the writer also happened to be the director, then I was really intent on giving Paul what he wanted. I just think that, you know, rightly or wrongly, certainly not in every situation, but I think the director's the captain of the ship. You know, I always look at myself as one of the crew. Unless it's Bly, and then I'd be happy to keyhole them like the rest of them.
We'll take a break. My guest, the able-bodied seaman sitting across from me, is Sam Elliott. We're talking about a number of things, including the movie Grandma that he's in right now. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm trading nautical metaphors with my guest, Sam Elliott, who's had a pretty great year this year. We're talking about Justified and Grandma. My year started off with you twice at Sundance between Grandma and your other film with Bly Danner.
Yeah, that was a piece of work. Brett Haley's a writer, director. His partner, Mark Bosch, is his co-writer on this script. And it was just another, as I look at it, a gift that came to me out of that independent filmmaking world this year that just really made, well, it was actually last year, but it made the last 2 years of my life really special.
And tell the audience what your character's name is.
They referred to him on the page initially as Cigar Man. Because the first time you see him, and actually for a number of scenes, he's got this big cigar crammed in his mouth.
So. Which is one of the things I appreciate about the performance. Well, that's neither here nor there.
Thank you.
But I think that having a cigar is really funny. You basically almost played it like you were Jack Benny or Groucho Marx using that cigar to punctuate.
It was a great tool. It was a great prop. I'll put it that way.
But it was really fun to watch you do something like that because so often... I think you're such a physical actor that just seeing that physicality sort of extend itself to using that prop as an expression of character, and also just watching this the fun you had in using that as a way to wait out the lines and and getting her characters to pay attention to that cigar was pretty fun.
Thank you. You give me much more credit than I think I'm due. I didn't really think about it anything other than I was enjoying a cigar and wanting to light it every time I put it in my mouth, which he never does. You know, he never did fire it up.
Which becomes part of the weird tension in
it.
You went, okay, this guy clearly likes cigars.
Yeah.
When's he going to smoke it?
Yeah. I think I'm sure Bly said to me at one point, are you ever going to light that thing? She said. He says, I used to light them all the time, you know.
But, now, when did that come? That idea come of never lighting the cigar? Was that you, or was
no? That was
Brett.
That was in Brett's screenplay. You know, the guy had been a smoker and got by it, but didn't get by it totally. You know, he had that oral fixation, as he said to her. You know, somebody once said I had an oral fixation, so I guess it's true. But he'd gotten by the smoking thing. He was trying to be healthier in his old age, I think he said.
Let's go back to what you were saying about your experience with Lifeguard. I mean, there's some part of you that didn't take that whole star-making machinery seriously. Mm. I mean, some part of it seemed like a crock to you or a joke on some level, did it not?
Well, you know, it's kind of a long, boring tale. But, you know, we made this movie, and it was a film of, number one, it was a coming-of-age story for the Kathleen Quinlan character.
But also a coming-of-age story for your
and
character, too.
And it was for me as well.
This
but it was really about
era.
A guy that had come to a point in his life where everybody was expecting him to move on. And he was in a niche where he really loved what he was doing, and he was going to continue being a lifeguard. You know, and it's an admirable pursuit, you know, being a lifeguard. They're civil servants, as far as I'm concerned. I know guys that are guards that have been guards all their life, that have had careers on the beach, and that's what this guy, Rick, was, you know. When it came to the advertising, they sold it like beach blanket bingo, and I kind of bristled at that. You know, I talked about it with Dan Petrie, and, you know, we all thought that, or Danny and I both thought they kind of sold it short, you know, because we took it as seriously as we did, and they treated it like, you know, a popcorn movie. The one sheet was I remember specifically, in fact, somebody offered me one to autograph last week when I was at a Q&A with Lily downtown. It was an animated picture, and I was in a Speedo and looking totally buffed, as I was at the time. And across the top it said, "Every girl's summer dream," you know. Anyway, they sold the movie like that. I went on the road with it for 6 weeks. Flew in and out back in the day. That was way before EPKs. You carried boxes of bios with you. You know, the people that did the interview mostly had always seen the film before the interview the next morning. We'd go one city one day, one city another day. And invariably, every time I'd get into an interview, it would start out with the interview saying, "This movie is nothing like I expected it to be." And me being young, glib, smart-ass, and not very smart, honest, opinionated, would just, that's all I needed, man, and I just went after it. My mom died a couple of years ago up in Portland, Oregon. She had the archive on Sam Elliott in her house, and she had all these articles from that period of time, and I read through them all, and I ended up burning them about a week later. They were really kind of an eye-opener, or what a kind of a... I might have been wrong in my own mind at that time, saying the things I said, but they were not very smart.
Well, the honest, smart man sitting across from me is Sam Elliott. We're talking about his career, but his most current film, of course, is his Grandma. And you can still see I See You in My Dreams in many theaters around the country. I guess I will ask you this, though, Sam, because it sounds like you just had to say what you thought. And my guess is that's something you've kept in mind all the time. I mean, you're basically
I'm
honest.
I'm still that way.
Yeah.
I'm still that way. I've always thought that it was, the right way to go. You know, it was kind of the way I grew up. As being a gentleman was the way I grew up, you know, it's just the way I was raised by my folks. But I think it's often misunderstood to be that forthcoming. And I think you can get a reputation of not being, you know, not playing ball or not, you know, I don't know. I was honest and opinionated with George Lucas one time, and I don't think that was a thing to be.
What happened?
You know. It was back when they were doing Raiders. I was doing Once an Eagle at the same time at Universal. And I had an opportunity to go meet with he and Spielberg on Raiders. And I remember in the course of this meeting, you know, George was sitting there behind this giant desk. And, you know, it kept coming around to what I did with my time. And as you said earlier on in this interview about why didn't you study? Lucas asked me if I studied, and I said, "No, I don't. I don't study." And he kept kind of needling me about why I didn't study, and I just told him that, you know, I think that the work is what teaches you. You know, I've been very fortunate to continue working. I learn every time out. I learn on the job, and I just said I'm prepared to wait it out. You know, I live in West L.A. I pay $200 a month rent. I manage a little apartment that I live in, and I'm not under pressure to work to get by, and I came here for a career, and I'm going to wait for it to come to me. And he said, "Well, what if it doesn't come?" And I just, you know, not even thinking about it, I just said, "Well, fuck 'em." I was just thinking, well, if it doesn't come, it doesn't come. I'm gonna do it that way, and I'm going to wait it out, and, you know, try to do good work, and But boy, as soon as I said that, man, it was like a shot of a character in a cartoon. It was like his eyelids dropped down and it said, out, you know. Anyway, I ended up testing, but didn't come my way.
And did you talk to Spielberg about that at all, too? Did you have conversations with him as well?
He was in the office when I had that conversation with
George. So he was there for
He was there. And I ran into Steven a couple of times in a market out in Malibu where we live, and worked with his wife, Kate Capshaw, a couple of years after that, before they were married. I was working with his girlfriend at the time when we met, Amy Irving, on Once an Eagle. But, you know, it's what goes on, you know. I had an agent one time, a man named Bill Haber at the William Morris office, who I was with forever, for a long time, I'll put it that way. He was my television agent, and Ron Meyer was my theatrical agent. This was at William Morris before they went off and formed CAA, which I went with them when they did that. And I remember Bill Haber telling me, I used to go into Bill's office. His office was open to me. I knew where the breakdowns were of all the stuff that was coming through the mill. And he said, you can come in here anytime, and I did. I took advantage of that. I was under contract at Fox at the time. But I remember being in Bill's office one time complaining about something. I don't know what it was, not working or not getting some job. And he just looked me right in the eye, and he says, well, maybe you're not as good as you think you are. And I've carried that with me, God bless Bill Haber, ever since. Because, it may be true.
But what would the guys like Ron Meyer, Bill Haber, what would they say to you about not playing the game, which you were pretty steadfast in
Bill
doing?
Bill Haber one time told me at Ronnie's house, years later, this is after Ron was, and they were both away from CAA, Bill's in New York producing Broadway shows, Ron Meyer's running Universal. And I remember seeing Bill, it was the first time I'd seen him in years. And I think it was right about the time a movie called The Hulk came out, the first Hulk. And he just said, he just had this kind of funny Bill Haber grin on his face. And he said, well, you did it. And he said, you did it your way. You know, and it was like, but I never thought about it that way. I never thought about it, you know, being a Sinatra song, you know. I had something in mind, and I followed it, right or wrong.
And you had to do it the way you had to do it.
Yeah, and still do.
Well, you know what? And it's still paying off for you, obviously. So you had to wait for it to come to you the way it did. But here's the thing. I will say this to you. The people who paid attention to you, the Coens, for example, I mean, they wrote that for Sam Elliott.
They did.
Did they not?
My name was in the script. In the voiceover in the beginning, that was when I remember thinking, oh, Jesus, really? You know, there's a song, Tumbling Tumbleweeds, playing in the background, and there's this southern voice, this southern drawl voice, sounding not unlike Sam Elliott. And then the guy shows up in the bar, looking not unlike Sam Elliott, you know. So that was a treat. God, I'll tell you somebody that I'd truly love working with and who've admired since day one, and that's Jeff Bridges. You know, Jeff and I are pretty much contemporaries, and his volume of work is just so incredible, and I felt so lucky to be with him there. I
mean, and that put you on a path of working with him again.
He is truly the dude. Yeah, and Rod Lurie, when I met with Rod Lurie and read The Contender, he said, you know, I watched The Big Lebowski last week, and I just wanted to see more of the you and the dude. So that's why I want you to do my movie.
Well, we're out of time. You have to come back and do the show again, please.
I would love to, Elvis. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. My guest who just goes the show, slow and steady wins the race, is Sam Elliott. Please go see him, and I'll see you in my dreams. The last couple seasons of Justified, and of course, Grandma. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Peter Stenchel. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's the producer. I'm not Sam Elliott. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.